All right, so today's lecture is supposed to be a review, and I should point out that it's Rob's idea to have a review lecture, so he's the main responsible person. Now, clearly, in one lecture, I cannot repeat everything that you said in all the previous lectures, so that's not going to be my goal. So I'm just going to give some kind of a review of the main highlights and hopefully maybe put things in the right perspective. So, well, we'll see how useful the lecture will be. So like I said, this is going to be a review of the lecture so far. And so the plan basically will be the following. So first I'll give some introduction into the ADS-CFT correspondence, a little bit about string theory and dbrains, and then about the correspondence. Then I'll review some things about n equals 4 super young mules. Then about the geometry of ADS. And then finally, a few tests and indications of the duality that you talked about in the previous lectures. So feel free to ask questions, but again, I should underline that there's not going to be any new groundbreaking thing today. It's just a review of the main highlights of the previous lectures. And it's going to be also more sketchy because there are many, many things that you said before. So this is going to be just a superficial overview. So, well, let me start first with the main point that I'm not going to motivate here the duality. We've talked so much about it, so you know that there's a good motivation to study it. But let me say a few words about string theory. So why we start with string theory? That's a string theory is our candidate for a unified description of all interactions in nature. And so it's a unified or at least one possibility to unify all interactions, unified description of all interactions in nature. And the basic idea is that instead of having various elementary particles, we just have elementary strings, and strings vibrate, and the different modes of vibration give different elementary particles. So, different elementary particles are just different modes of vibration of strings. So we have some space-time, let's say that this is the time direction and this is space. And we have some strings propagating. And so they sweep some world sheet. So if we denote the string world sheet with sigma, and the coordinates x mu are coordinates in space-time. Then we can describe the strings just as the embedding of the world sheet in space-time. So these are coordinates x mu as functions of sigma and tau, where sigma and tau are the coordinates on the world sheet. So this is the embedding of the world sheet in, let's call space-time just x. So we can write then an action for those fields, those coordinates of, in space-time, as functions of the coordinates on the world sheet. And we can quantize that action. And this is going to give us a description of nature, hopefully. So we have an action describing the string. Which is just integral over the world sheet. Well, there is some coefficient, which is the string tension. It's not so important for these purposes. So integral over the world sheet. And these are derivatives of the coordinates. Write it this way so that I can write also the metric. So, and this is, so we can quantize this action like usual, derive the equations of motion and quantize them. And so I'm not going to go through all those details, but when we quantize this action, we find some interesting things. So we find that for quantum mechanical consistency, for quantum mechanical consistency, the dimension of this space-time in which the strings propagate is actually not 4. The dimension of x, x was the space-time in which the strings propagate. So actually, I haven't been very specific here, but if we consider the bosonic string, the dimension is 26. Whereas for the superstring, that is going to be the main interest, it's 10. So the dimension of space-time is not 4. So because of that, in order to obtain particle physics, we have to compactify 6 dimensions. So here, I'm assuming the superstring. So we have 10 dimensions for the superstring. We compactify 6, and then we are left with some 4-dimensional effective field theory. And this is going to be the particle physics model that we are going to be obtaining from this compactification. Now, for the purposes of this course, actually, compactification is not so important. More important is what we find in the spectrum of strings when we quantize. Namely, the more important thing here is that there are also some other fields that are called Ramon-Ramon fields. So let me mention another point. Clearly, there are two kinds of strings, open and closed. And as far as unification of particles goes, one can see that in the spectrum of the open strings, one can find gauge fields. So, and their supersymmetric partners, these superstrings here. So if we talk about particles that we know, this is going to be the photon here in this spectrum. Whereas in the spectrum of closed strings, one finds the graviton and a supersymmetric partner. So this is the origin of gravity. So we can see how open and closed strings together have all the ingredients to describe particle physics. Now, the important point that I was saying is that in the spectrum of the closed string, this is all at the lowest level, massless level, although spectra, lowest massless level. So the important point is that in the spectrum of the closed string, in addition to the graviton and its superpartner, the gravitino, one also finds, well, there is the B field, but more important, one also finds so-called Ramon-Ramon fields. And we also talked about these fields in the course before. Can anybody see here behind this? So why are the, okay, before going further into Ramon-Ramon fields, let me just mention that the other reason to be interested in superstrings, not just because 10 is less than 26, but the other reason is also because when you quantize, you find that in the spectrum of the bosonic string, there's a tachyon at the lowest lying level. So the bosonic string is really not the suitable theory to consider. Or one can view it as unstable and decaying into something else. So we're going to study the superstring, and that means also that there has to be some fermionic extension here that I'm not going to write explicitly. So now back to the Ramon-Ramon fields. So in fact, the superstring has different kinds. I'm not going to go into detail, but you probably have heard about 2A and 2B. And so the Ramon-Ramon fields that are present in 2A and 2B are different kinds. So in type 2A strings, there are the following Ramon-Ramon potentials. So the Ramon-Ramon potentials are a 1-form, a 3-form, a 5-form, 7-form, 9-form. So these are odd forms, whereas in type 2B, one finds Ramon-Ramon potentials that are even forms. C0, C2, C4, C6, C8. So this 5 means that there are 5 indices, right? And this is anti-symmetric with respect to all 5 indices. So anti-symmetric. So these are all forms, form potentials. And let me go here. And in fact, there are some dualities between them. So for example, the field strength of C1 is, this is 10-dimensional Hodge star, the C7, and so on. So which is also related to electric-magnetic duality. Now, why I'm mentioning those potentials? Well, if we just think about a charged particle in electromagnetism, a charged particle couples to the electromagnetic potential in the following way. Just integral over A mu dx mu, where this is the one-dimensional world line of the particle in space-time. Now, similarly to that, we have, for all those potentials, we have objects that couple in similar way. So in string theory, objects, these are the D-brains, that are Ramon-Ramon charged, and well, actually, they are Ramon-Ramon charged because of that coupling. But okay, sorry for this we have sentencing. So couple in the following way. So one integrates the Ramon-Ramon potential over some world volume. And well, okay, let me write this out also. Since this is anti-symmetric, this is the epsilon tensor. Now this world volume that we integrate over, this is the world volume of the deep brain. So this is a world volume of a DP brain. That's why I wrote P plus one here so that I can write DP brain. So for each of those Ramon-Ramon potentials, there is a corresponding object that is a D brain of a different dimensionality. And odd and even are different in types 2a and b. And also that is related to this kind of electric and magnetic duality. So for example, the relation that dc3 is equal to the star of dc5, this would mean that d2 that couples to c3, if this is electrically charged with respect to c3, then d4 is magnetically charged. With respect to C3, because it couples electrically to C5, which is the dual of C3. So now we've introduced the concept of D brains, and actually, there is another way of describing them that is how Puchinsky got to the idea. So D brains can be described at weak coupling as boundary conditions for open strings. And actually, by weak coupling here, I mean one can actually find out that the proper coupling is G string times N, where N is the number of brains. So I should say that here I'm considering a stack of N brains. When I say D brains from now on, I'm not going to every time mention that I'm considering a stack of D brains, but you should always consider their N. So at weak coupling, one can define them as boundary conditions for open strings . So we have the picture that there are some hyperservices in some higher dimensional space, and open strings are constrained to end on those surfaces. Or in other words, one can say that the world volume, degrees of freedom of the D brain are the open strings, or described by the open strings. Now, at strong coupling, this picture is not suitable anymore, and instead, at strong coupling, the better description is in terms of some curved geometry. Curved geometry plus some non-trivial Ramon-Ramon fields. Plus some Ramon-Ramon flux background. So this is very much like Reisner and Nordstrom black holes, black hole backgrounds. So now, having those two pictures in mind, we can formulate the idea CFT, or more generally, gauge gravity duality. Let's see. So let's consider, let's start with some configuration like this. So far, I'm just kind of reviewing the lectures that Rob gave in the beginning. So consider some, I'm not going to have space enough here. Well, I'll continue on the other boards. So consider some brains, stack of brains and open strings, constraints to end on them, and some closed strings propagating in the space around. So now if we take the low energy limit, we are going to restrict ourselves to the lowest lying levels in the spectrum of these open strings that end on the brain. And this then gives us a Young-Mills theory. So we find a super Young-Mills, which is the lowest level in open string spectrum. Plus closed strings propagating in 10-dimensional spacetime, which we're going to ignore in a moment, but let me write them for now. On the other hand, here taking strongly coupled limit, we find the description that was in terms of a curved geometry and non-trivial Ramon-Ramon fields. So here we find curved geometry plus our fluxes backgrounds. Again, plus the 10-dimensional strings, that closed strings that propagate in this background, plus closed strings So, well, like I said, I'm going to neglect the closed strings on both sides. So now, if we go to strong coupling here, we end with a strongly coupled Young mules. Whereas at low energy here, well, we are left really just with the supergravity background. That is, so in principle, there could be stringy corrections, but at low energies, we're just left with a Sugra background, which means some trivial metric and Ramon-Ramon fields. And then the duality that was first stated by Molasena is that those two descriptions are equivalent. So let me write this maybe here. So according to Molasena, strongly coupled super Young mules is equivalent to, well, by Sugra solution, I just mean some curved geometry and Ramon-Ramon fields that satisfy the supergravity equations of motion. And this is equivalence or duality. And this statement was made a bit more precise by Witten, who actually realized that one can make it useful for computation. Well, by formulating it in this way, so the two sides of this duality, the strongly coupled field theory and the gravitational background, have equal partition functions. So the partition function of the QFT is equal to the string partition function. Here I again mean that usually one restricts to a supergravity approximation, but there could be stringy corrections. So, and in particular, one can use this to compute correlation functions in the following way. So if you want to compute correlators in the field theory, you have to turn on some source. So so let me write first the expectation value of, so now phi zero is a source for some operator. So this is an operator in the field theory. Well, in field theory. The one specified for now, which field theory, or well, anyhow, let's call this QFT. So this is going to be equal to the string partition function as a function of this source, which here is the boundary value of some corresponding bulk cube. On this side, this is just a source. For this operator. And here, most of the time, people just use the leading approximation, which is supergravity. It's really classical approximation. So one is left with, on this side, exponential minus the supergravity action as sugra as a function of these boundary values. So from this relation, now one can compute correlators in the usual way. Say now, if you want to compute an endpoint function, then this is going to be varying with respect to the sources. And this minus the sugra action as a function of those sources. So the basic statement of the gauge gravity duality is that the gravitational action as a function of the boundary values is the generating functional for the correlators of the dual field theory. And that statement is used actually in a much more general context than just ADA CFT, which hopefully we'll talk about at the end of this course. So let me just try this statement and then I'll move on. So the basic statement that allows things to be computed via gauge gravity duality The basic statement is that the gravitational action is the generating functional for the correlators of the dual field theory. Okay, now this was about the general part. Now I'm going to the particular case of ADA CFT. So the best understood example of all this is ADA CFT, which is the case that arises when one considers D3 brains. It's not very good. So this arises from stack of n, it's really not a big joke, D3 brains. And it's best understood because it has the most symmetry and supersymmetry, and so it's technically most manageable. Now, in this case, for D3 brains, we have that the world volume degrees of freedom are described by n equals 4 super m mu's. Which is also a conformal field theory. That's the origin of CFT. And the background that is sourced by this stack of brains is ADS5 times S5, which is the origin of ADS. So now I'm going to talk a bit more about each of those two, the super M mu's and then the ADS background. So let me go on this side. Let me know if all of this is very boring. There isn't anything really new so far, but I thought it might be nice to kind of summarize these things before going further. Okay, so according to the plan now, this is finally part two, n equals 4 super m mu's. Well, first of all, this is a supersymmetric field theory. So I assume that you know basically what supersymmetric is, but in general, it's just some transformation that relates bosons and fermions, transforms them into each other. So the field content of this theory is the following. And n equals 4 means that there are 4 different transformations that this theory is invariant under. So field content there is first a gauge field, SUN, gauge field. Remember that we had n D brains in the stack, so this is the same n from the D brains, and this is the number of supersymmetries. That's why, like in the literature, it's usually denoted curly to not confuse it with this one. Then there are also fermions, which are supersymmetric partners, and there are 4 of them. So this is some spinor index. Well, and I, capital I, goes from 1 to 4. So these are fermions, which, since they are superpartners of the gauge field, are called gaugini. And also there are scalar fields, where this index goes from 1 to 6. And in fact, these scalar fields, one can recognize that they are the Goldstone bosons for the six broken translational symmetries. Remember that when you have a brain here, this arises from the D3 brain. So that means that there are four dimensions, the world volume dimension of the D3, that still translational invariance is not broken. But the six transfer dimensions, in them translational invariance is broken. And these are exactly the scalars that are positions in those dimensions and can be viewed as the Goldstone bosons for those broken translational symmetries. So and this is the field content of an n equals 4 supermultiplet. So this is n equals 4 supermultiplet. So I'm not going to go into details about this, but let me just mention that for every supersymmetric theory, there is a technically much more convenient way of describing it. Instead of using component fields, one can introduce so-called superfields. And a superfield is a way to combine together all the components of the supermultiplet, all bosons and fermions that are transformed into each other by supersymmetry. So then one can directly write supersymmetric invariant actions by just writing actions in terms of superfields. So the language of superfields and superspace is very convenient, but it's not necessary, so we're not going to study in depth this here. And just in case, let me also remind you the Lagrangian for n equals 4 superangles. That's also not essential for later, but just for completeness. So the other thing that probably you remember, all fields here are in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So this is a gauge field. I should have said also that that means that one can write it as an expansion in the generators. And since supersymmetry relates all fields here to the gauge field, all of them are also in the adjoint representation. So in particular, there are no fundamental fermions here. That may be important later on for the end of the course, when I hope to discuss some other gauge gravity dualities in which one can have fundamental fermions and study other things like chiral symmetry breaking and such, which is not the case here. So this is a very interesting theory, but it has its limitations for practical purposes. So the action, the Lagrangian is F square plus dxi square. So I'm suppressing always the indices A. It's a little bit schematic. And also one can have the theta angle. So like I said, there's no need to go into more details, so I'm not going to write the Suster transformations. Let me just mention, since I was mentioning superspace, in principle, in order to describe a supersymmetric field theory in superspace, one needs to introduce anti-commuting coordinates. So for example, in n equals 1 superspace, one has just, that's not the theta angle. It's just it's usually denoted by also theta. These are the coordinates that one adds to the x mu coordinates. Whereas in n equals 2, one would have two pairs, say theta 1, theta 1 bar, theta 2, theta 2 bar. For n equals 4, that would be relevant there. There will be 4. And one can also decompose higher n into multiplets with lower representations. So anyhow, superspace is not really essential. So that's just a side comment, since we also mentioned a little bit in the lectures before. Let's see, where should I go here? Now, for n equals 4 super young mu's, people have computed that the beta function vanishes. So in principle, for a supersymmetric field theory, there will be a one-loop contribution plus maybe some non-perturbative contributions. But for n equals 4, it has been shown that the beta function vanishes. So this is a conformal field theory. So n equals 4 super young mu's is, well, scale and conformal invariant. So let me say now some words about conformal symmetry. Well, first let me define the conformal group. As transformations that preserve the metric up to an overall rescaling. So conformal transformations are the transformations that preserve the metric up to overall rescaling. In other words, one has that the S squared goes to some overall conformal factor that may depend on the coordinates, so it may be local times the S squared. And in four dimensions, here we're considering four-dimensional super young mu's, since the D3 world volume is four-dimensional. So in four dimensions, the conformal group has 15 generators. So the generators are the following. First, there is translations. That are generated in the following way. So there are four translation generators, then there are rotations, and their generators look like this. X mu, these are the coordinates in four dimensions. D nu minus x nu d mu. So these are 4, 6. Then there is the rotation. Which is generated by x mu d mu. And finally, special conformal transformations. Special conformal transformations that are generated by the following. X nu, d mu minus 2 x nu d mu. So this is contracted, and these are contracted. So one can see that those generators indeed satisfy the appropriate commutation relations. But one can also see that by rearranging them, go here. So by rearranging those generators, one can see that in fact the conformal group is isomorphic to SO42. So let me also mention that, because that's relevant for the IDA-CFT relation. So I'm not going to show here that those generators satisfy the appropriate commutation relations for the conformal group. I think we've seen that in the lectures. Now let's see how to regroup them. We can define say new generators that are J mu nu is the same as M mu nu. J mu D. So actually D in that case is 4, but in general I'm going to show now that it's isomorphic to SO P plus 1 Q plus 1. So let me first try those and then I'll be a bit more specific. So 1/2 P mu minus C mu. J mu D plus 1. Again, in this case, this is just 5. But in general, it doesn't have to be. And J D plus 1 D is equal to the dilatation generator. So one can see then that those generators J satisfy the commutation relations for SO p plus 1, q plus 1. Okay, I'm not going to write all of this, plus some other things. So in this way, one can see that the conformal group in RPQ is isomorphic to SO q plus 1 q plus 1. And here in this notation, D is just p plus q. So again, in the case of the ADS CFT, or the relevant example is R31, and then the isometry is SO42. But this is true more generally. So by this regrouping, one can see that these are the appropriate commutation relations for SO. Okay, enough for this. Oh, let me just also mention, it's probably clear, but the indices A, B, C, D here go from 0, 1 to D plus 1, which again is equal to 5 in the case of ADS 15. So, okay. So in a conformal field theory, conformal invariance actually restricts a lot the various correlators. So conformal invariance imposes restrictions on the correlators of the theory. Actually, how strong the restrictions are depends on the dimension, but still, even in four dimensions, there are some restrictions, well, severe restrictions, at least for two-point and three-point functions. So one can derive those restrictions. I'm not going to go through that, but just let me mention. By considering a variation, say, of some endpoint function, and requiring that it vanishes. And I think in one of the lectures that some of you gave, this was considered in quite some detail. And so in particular, one can find that for two-point functions, the most general form that is allowed is the following. It's just some constant, which I don't remember and I'm not going to give now, but it's some constant divided by x1 minus x2 to power delta 1 plus delta 2, where those delta are the conformal dimensions. Delta I goes from 1 to 2, is conformal dimension of phi I. And let me also remind you that the conformal dimension is actually can be read off in the following way. We see how the dilatation operator acts on phi I at the origin. And this gives minus I delta I. And for some other generic point, we can obtain phi with the translation acting on phi 0. Okay, so there is also restriction for three-point functions. These restrictions are important since in the ADCT correspondence, one can obtain then from the gravity side the same kind of relation. So that's an important test that those restricted correlators can be reproduced. So for the three-point functions, the general form is the following. Sum, and again there are some coefficients that I'm not going to write explicitly. Okay, I'll introduce now some shorthand notation. R12 to power A, R23 to power B, and R31 to power C, where R12 is x1 minus x2, and so for the other r's. And also a plus b plus c is equal to the sum of the dimensions. So, okay, I don't think I want to say much more about that. So I'm not also going to spend much time on this, but let me just mention there is also so-called state operator correspondence that is due to the conformal symmetry. So one can map every initial state to some operator acting at the origin of a flat space, which may be suitable for using radial quantization. But anyhow, I'm not going to discuss anymore this. So now I'm turning to ADS. So now the third point in the plan was ADS. So I'll consider ADS 5 geometry. So like I mentioned before, this comes from considering D3 brains. So the full D3 brain metric, again, this is for a stack of n D3 brains, is the following. Some function h to the power minus 1/2. Dx squared, whereas this is the four-dimensional Minkowski space, plus h to 1/2. And here I'll use the radial distance away from the brains, r squared d omega 5. So this is the six-dimensional transverse space, and this is the world volume directions, and this function h is equal to 1 plus some constant that is going to be related to the cosmological constant in ADS divided by r to the fourth. And well, and there is also some Ramon-Ramon flux, which is not essential for this. So at large r, we can see that this function goes to 1. So at large r, the metric goes to metric on flat R91, whereas near the horizon, we have a different approximation. Near horizon, this means that L over R is much greater than 1. In this case, from this metric, we find ds squared, R squared over L squared, eta mu, the flat metric, dx mu, dx nu, plus L squared dr squared divided by r squared plus L squared d omega 5. Now, this is the 5 sphere, S5, and this is ADS 5. We see actually how the brain world volume got absorbed there. So, and we can also do a change of coordinates to transform this metric into the form that was more familiar to you before, the Poincaré patch. So we can do change of variables in the following way. You can introduce a variable z that is L squared over R. And then the ADS 5 part becomes so now I've dropped the S5 since it's not important anymore. So the ADS 5 part in this coordinate becomes L squared over Z squared dx mu plus dz squared, which is the familiar metric from the Poincaré patch. And let me also mention that the cosmological constant of ADS is proportional to minus 1 over L, something like that. Now, more generally, ADS is actually a maximally symmetric space. And that means that the curvature tensor is equal to the following. So the Riemann tensor so I believe that this constant is probably just for 4 dimensions. In high dimensions, it's still going to be just some number, but it will depend on the dimension. So this is probably just for, well, OK, I'm not exactly sure about this number. I forgot to check that. But anyhow, it's some number that depends on the dimension in general, the scalar curvature, which is constant. And the important point is the following, mu sigma g mu rho, oh, sorry, rho, g mu rho, g mu sigma. So this simple form, the curvature tensor has only for the maximally symmetric spaces, which are ADS, DS, and Minkowski. For Minkowski, the scalar curvature is 0. For ADS, it's negative, and for the sitter, it's positive. So these are the only 3 cases where, in general, the curvature tensor is so simple. Now, one can also define ADS. And now I'm going to just talk about Lorentzian, although we talked about Euclidean before Lorentzian, but I'm going to skip that. So Lorentzian ADS is a hyperboloid. Embedded in some higher dimensional flat space. So to be more concrete, let's take more generally ADS P plus 2. Again, in our case, P is going to be 3 for the D3 brain, and so we're going to have ADS 5. So in general, ADS P plus 2 then is the locus defined in the following way. That's the flat metric eta times xA, xB. These are coordinates in the higher dimensional flat space, such that this is equal to minus some constant. So points that satisfy this inside are P plus 1, 2. So this hypersurface, this hyperboloid in that higher dimensional flat space is another way of defining ADS. And to be more explicit, we can write this. Let me write this out. Minus x0. So 2 means that there are two negative directions, two time-like directions, plus xi squared. This goes from 1 to p plus 1. And we have chosen the other time-like direction to be p plus 2. And this thing is equal to minus l squared. And we can go to the boundary or projective boundary of this space by the following rescaling. So let's rescale x as lambda x tilde. And then we're going to have eta ab x tilde a x tilde b equals minus l squared over lambda squared. So then take the limit lambda going to infinity. And then we're going to find from here this relation. And so the solutions of these are the points in, so I was using p plus 2, so this is our p1. So that's how we see that there is a match between the symmetries of the conformal theory and the boundary of ADS. So now there isn't that much time left, but let me just mention briefly a few tests or indications for the duality that we discussed. So that's the fourth point in the plan. So last point is checks or indications. For ADS CFT. So the first point, I already said, matching of the symmetries. namely both for the conformal field theory and the boundary of ADS, the symmetry group is SO42. Another indication that we've considered was actually in a different order, but it was the large N expansion, Hoft expansion. Where we saw in some of the earlier lectures, in one earlier lecture, we saw that actually at large n, Young mu's resembles very much the string expansion, well, like perturbative string expansion. With string coupling that is proportional to 1 over n. So large n expansion, Young mu's. And we also considered the relation between masses of various fields and dimensions of dual operators and the computation of endpoint functions. So let me briefly mention something about that. Say masses, dimensions, and endpoint functions. So with respect to the relation between masses and dimensions, let's just consider a scalar field. Scalar field in the curved background that is ADS 5. So study QFT in curved background, which is ADS5. And let's take a scalar field for simplicity. So we have an action that is, since we're in ADS5, this is just going to be D5x. G mu nu d nu phi plus m squared phi plus some higher order maybe interactions that are not essential right now. And well, in principle, there is also a boundary term. Let me write it just for completeness. This is the metric induced on the boundary. This is the normal to the boundary. So we can derive the field equation here, and we can find solutions. So, well, solve the equation of motion, which is with appropriate boundary conditions. And we see that the field phi has to behave in the following way. So, well, we preserve translational invariance along x, and in z direction, there is some power here that from the equation of motion, we find that it's related to the mass in the following way. Okay, so this for A d plus 1 for radius d plus 1. So for radius 5, this is just 4, equals m squared l squared. So in particular, there are two solutions, plus minus. I promise I'll end soon. D over 2 plus minus square root d over 2 square plus m square l square. So again, this was for ADS d plus 1, which in this case d plus 1 is 5, so d is 4. So, and similarly, one can write the actions for other fields, gauge fields or fermions in ADS 5 background, and solve the equations of motion and find the relations between dimensions of operators and the mass of the fields. And in general, to compute endpoint functions, now the recipe is the following. So, well, find Green's function. Find the bulk to boundary propagator, which is the limit of the Green's function when one of the points goes to the boundary. And then, well, one can use Witten diagrams, but okay, let me. A bit more precise. So let's denote the bulk to boundary propagator by K. So we saw in one of the lectures that K is actually equal to, let's say, K of Z X X prime. I'll finish in a moment, I promise. Some constant that I'm not going to write in detail times Z to power delta plus divided by z square plus x minus x prime square to delta plus. There is no z prime here because this is the bulk to boundary propagator. So the point z prime is already been sent to the boundary. Now, the key point is that then at a generic point, the field phi x of z can be obtained by integrating over the x prime, the bulk to boundary propagator, z x x prime, and then the boundary. So x prime here is on the boundary. So this is our boundary condition. And the reason we want to write the field in this way, the reason it's useful to introduce this bulk to boundary propagator, is because, if you remember earlier, I mentioned that the endpoint functions are obtained by varying the gravity action with respect to the boundary conditions. So we want to write explicitly the field in terms of the boundary conditions. So then these are our sources. We differentiate with respect to them. And so then the endpoint functions just become some products of bulk to boundary propagators or bulk to bulk propagators. And these are the Witten diagrams that I mentioned here. So, okay, I'm almost done. Maybe I should just write this one last time. So then an endpoint function is a obtained by varying with respect to the boundary values. Which is why we wanted to solve explicitly the field in terms of the boundary values. And this is the Sugra action as a function of those boundary values. So when we use that explicit solution, this just gives us Witten diagrams. Okay, I guess maybe that's everything I wanted to say. Maybe also let me mention that we considered briefly, finally, Wilson whoops. So these are non-local operators that are useful for studying confinement. And okay, I guess I'm running out of time, so let me just mention that. Well, okay, I guess that's it. It's not so important to go into that detail. Let me just mention that in the string, on the string side, the Wilson loops in the gauge theory can be just computed by they're given by the minimal area that is the worldsheet of a string ending on the loop. So that's the basic point, and I think that's all I wanted to say. I don't know whether the lack of questions means that it was totally boring or, well, anyhow, that was my vision of a review so far. Feel free to complain. So, well, that's it.